Okay, as soon as I see Attorney Ross's face, we're going to be ready to roll, I think. Okay, Attorney Roth, you're muted. You both, well, I know, Attorney Roth, you do. You've been before us a number of times in this format. Attorney Walsh, I don't know if you know, but whenever you speak, you have to unmute your microphone, and then generally it helps our sound if you're muted when you don't need to be speaking. So we are all assembled, so I'll call our case for the morning, Wisconsin Legislature versus Andrea Palm. My notes tell me that Attorney Walsh, you're going to have 40 minutes. Attorney Roth, you're going to have 45 minutes. And then Attorney Walsh back again for five-minute rebuttal. Is that what you have agreed on?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Very good. And I'll, if you are ready to proceed, Attorney Walsh, you may begin.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Ryan Walsh of Imer Stahl on behalf of the Wisconsin Legislature. With me in the room today are my colleagues, Amy Miller and John Adams. The coronavirus crisis raises a number of fundamental and complex policy questions. Those are not the questions before this court today. This case is not about whether a lockdown is a good idea, how far one should go, or whether and when Wisconsin should reopen in the months or years before a vaccine is developed. It's not even about the governor's ample powers to respond to a public health emergency under Section 323.10. Subject to the legislature's oversight. This case instead raises first a basic issue of administrative law, whether the most consequential, sweeping regulation likely ever issued in our state's history, applicable to every person, synagogue, church, mosque, business, city, town, and county in Wisconsin, is a general order of general application within the meaning of Section 227.01 sub 13, and therefore subject to Chapter 227's rulemaking procedures. The answer is clearly yes. The text of the statute and a unanimous line of precedence puts this point beyond doubt. The department therefore needs to do what it should have done in the first place, sit down at a table with the very body whose powers it exercises and which created the department in the first place, the legislature.
Council, this morning, let's dive into that. What is it that makes something a general order?
It's, Your Honor, an order that is applicable beyond the circumstances of, say, a contested case or a private letter ruling. So an order applicable to a specifically enumerated person or group of persons that does not that does not constitute a class is how the statute defines it in sub 13. So that's the line. Whether it's a general order of general application on the one side or an order that applies to specifically enumerated persons that do not themselves constitute a general class. And there may be cases that fall on either side of that line occasionally, Your Honor, and are close to that line. This is not that case.
Well, I want to just make sure I understand the distinction. I mean, general order is one part of the statutory requirement, but general of general application is considered a second part. So I want to get your understanding of what each of those mean and then just follow up on that.
Sure. So a general order would be one that is not applicable to an entire class, or in this case, the entire state. A general order would be something that an agency issues outside of the context of a contested case or some adjudication. Generally, in administrative law, as Your Honor knows, there are adjudications and there are rules or regulations. This is in the first category. And I'll remind Your Honor that actually the question of whether this is a general order is not contested in this case. Yep. The question in this case is whether it's of general application. And that, as I said, can occasionally be a hard question, but it isn't here because we know of no order that is more sweeping or that applies to more people than Emergency Order 28 in the history of our state.
So do you think that an order prohibiting public gatherings of greater than 50 people statewide is a general order of general application?
Yes, it would be, Your Honor.
Okay.
It applies to a group of persons who, if not specifically enumerated, constitute a general class. It would apply statewide, and therefore it would be a general order of general application.
What about
issues? Just yeah. Sorry, Your Honor.
What about closing all the schools in the state? Would that be the same thing?
Same analysis, Your Honor. Same analysis.
What about in order closing the schools or limiting public gatherings for everyone living south of Highway 29?
Yes, Your Honor, it would be. That is a general class of people that's defined by something other than having their names enumerated in the order itself, and therefore they would be a general class.
So what about just applying to, say, Milwaukee County?
Yeah, I think that gets much closer. I think at that point you're enumerating particular entities that must close, and that arguably is an order not subject to Chapter 227. I think it would turn on the details of how the order is written, Your Honor.
So do you think that Secretary Palm could issue an order that closes all schools or closes all public gatherings if she issued 72 separate county-based orders? Would those all pass muster as not rules?
You know, I think 227 is not subject to sleight of hand, which that might be, Your Honor. I take the point that if she were to proceed order by order, and direct this particular store and that particular school and this particular church to close or forbid public gatherings in those spaces, it may be that they wouldn't need to proceed under 227. But again, I don't think that 227 allows that kind of easy circumvention. The point of 227 is to permit the legislature to oversee exercises of power that derive from the legislature in the first place. And as this court has held in numerous cases from Martinez on, that is a plainly legitimate exercise of legislative oversight. And this is the case that cries out for it. Again, those might be harder cases, Justice Hagedorn. This is not one of those.
I'm just trying to figure out, you know, when we read the statute and looking at how you draw the line, you've got kind of two competing theories here. And I want you to address your at least what I understand of your opposing counsel's argument here. But you seem to say if it applies to a large group of people who are not enumerated, you know, that constitutes a general order of general application. And I think the argument that Secretary Palm is making is that rulemaking is something that's intended to be replicatable. In other words, something that's a rule of general application means it applies to more than one factual circumstance. More than one situation, more than one, you know, emergency, if you will, something that would be future oriented. That's how I understand the competing definitions. And I'm wondering if you might comment on why you think that's not a better reading of what rulemaking, in fact, is designed to do, not be a specific factual circumstance versus something that applies, you know, to future situations as well, which this order clearly is time limited and it's not.
Yeah, Your Honor, the reason that argument doesn't work is that the emergency rulemaking procedures themselves contemplate a scenario in which there is a emerging set of circumstances to which an agency needs to respond immediately and in a time limited way. So under the emergency rule statutes, the rule is time limited by definition. By default, it can last no longer than 150 days. And of course, the agency is free to shorten the fuse even further. So necessarily under 227, you're dealing with a rule that's time limited, and necessarily you're dealing with a rule that's responding to a new set of circumstances and is prospective. There have been two emergency rules issued in the COVID-19 pandemic, one before this litigation began, and the other, a scope statement, is issued as of yesterday from the Department of Workforce Development. So This is, agencies know how to issue rules in emergencies. They are doing so in this emergency. And for whatever reason, DHS has chosen not to proceed that way, despite having numerous weeks in which to prepare a scope statement to issue the emergency rule and to have it on the books during this long 60-day emergency period that the governor has declared.
So just to make sure I understand, it would be your position that that Secretary Palm could issue an order closing all public gatherings greater than 50 people and closing schools, for example, in Milwaukee County, that would likely be permissible without promulgating a rule, but that once we get to some sort of undefined period of a much larger group, you would say that becomes problematic and needs to be promulgated as a rule.
That's basically right, Your Honor. I think it would depend how that hypothetical order is written, but certainly the legislature has drawn the line between general orders of general application on the one hand, and on the other, orders that are directed to a specifically named person or group of specifically named persons. I think you could write the Milwaukee County order in a way that that applies only to a group of specifically named persons that doesn't constitute a general class. So yes, Your Honor, I think that would be a much more viable path. It's certainly closer to the line, whereas this case is nowhere near the line.
And just to take that a little bit farther from where Justice Hagedorn was questioning this line, so you're basically saying that as long as it's enumerated, Secretary Palm may not have had to go through rulemaking. So in theory, that enumeration could have been very specific across a greater part of the state, correct? Not just Milwaukee County.
No, Your Honor, because once the enumeration of the group of specific persons that are bound by the order begins to constitute a general class, that becomes a general order of general application. That's where the legislature drew the line.
Well, and where is that line, though, counsel? I mean, you haven't given any parameters other than to say because it applies to the whole state, the line isn't there.
Your Honor, there are plenty of examples. DHS could issue an order requiring certain schools that meet certain criteria to close. It could issue an order requiring certain public gatherings in particular places in the state to be closed. It could require social distancing in public spaces. I mean, the order could be written in a number of ways that does not say all businesses except those arbitrarily deemed essential are closed. All travel is banned except that travel that's deemed arbitrarily essential.
Second. I was just reading your reply brief. It seems to say you're saying that the secretary couldn't even issue an order about social distancing. It would have to be advisory. That's what I read in your reply brief. Because otherwise, it's an order of law, and if someone could be face consequences under the law for not following social distancing, you're right back where you started. So, what do you say to that point?
Well, it's helpful to separate what DHS can do under its general powers and duties statute and the question what DHS can do subject to 227. There are all kinds of things DHS can do under its organic statute 25202 that are then subject to 227 rulemaking procedures. So we're not suggesting DHS is limited in some extreme way. They just have to operate through the ordinary emergency rulemaking channels that every other agency has to operate under.
All right, and can you address then the specific language in sub 4 of 252, which specifically added in 1981 the provision that DHS may issue any rule or order, and that such an order can be applicable to the whole or any specified part of the state? The legislature passed this enactment, understanding what the definition of a rule was at that time of general order of general application, and yet made this specific determination in 1981 that order was now falling into sub 4. How do you distinguish order and rule under those circumstances?
I don't have to distinguish order and rule under those circumstances, Your Honor, because 227 does so in the very definition of rule. 227.10 and 252 sub 4, the provision you're referencing, are perfectly harmonious. 252.024 says DHS can issue rules or orders, And 227 says some orders are rules for purposes of the procedural requirement, and some orders are just plain old orders not subject to the 227 procedures. There's no contradiction. There would need to be a clear contradiction in order for the later to implicitly repeal the former.
Specifically, what is an order made applicable to the whole of the state under your definition of a rule?
An order made applicable to the entire state is an order, a general order of general application. It is both an order and, for purposes of a procedural statute, a rule. It's important.
So there is no order. So under your reading, counsel, there is no order that you can make under sub 4 that would not already be a rule and would make this legislature adding that specific ability to issue orders totally superfluous.
That's not true, Your Honor, because there's also the second possibility, which is that an order could be issued to apply to statewide conduct, but not implement a statute or not have the force of law. There are several criteria for a rule under 227. So the social distancing advisory order, in your example, would be one. But the point is, it can be an order and a rule. That's what 227 itself says. The legislature couldn't be clearer. The legislature said, some orders are important enough that we want you to treat them as if they are rules and undergo the legislative review process that applies to all ordinary rules. There's no contradiction.
I still haven't heard from you, though, counsel. I haven't heard from you. When is it? I understand an order can be a rule. Absolutely. When is an order not a rule? And an advisory order is not an order. To advise someone of something, hey, we think you maybe should do this, that doesn't sound much like an order. So when is an order not a rule?
An order requiring particular schools, particular places of public establishment to close would be an order.
Applicable to the whole of the state. Applicable to the whole state. I'm looking exactly at the language of the statute that the legislature wrote. So when is it a rule? I mean, I want a circumstance. I'm not hearing one.
Right. So an order that directs certain people not to engage in certain conduct around the state could be an order, Your Honor.
Counsel, what I'm listening to Justice Dallet and also the answers to your questions to Justice Hagedorn. And I think what Justice Dallet is pressing you on is the question that she just asked, but I think you answered that. Maybe I didn't get that in your answer right. So let me know. I heard you say to Justice Hagedorn, there may be occasions that are a closer call, but this is not it, given the breadth of this order that's in place. It's a general order of general application. We could go through various hypotheticals that might be a closer call, but that this is not it. And I hear Justice Dallet pressing you on that, asking you for, well, tell me what's not a closer call. Tell me what the answer is. What could apply to the entire state that would satisfy you?
That's correct, Your Honor. And further to that, let's keep in mind that 227.10 or 227.01.13, the definition of a rule, has a very long list of exceptions. By my count, 70 subject matter exceptions. The legislature specifically enumerated the very many kinds of rules that it considers to be not subject to 227 rulemaking procedures. That's striking. That shows us that had the legislature meant to exempt DHS public health orders from the rulemaking requirements, it would have added a 71st exception. The legislature knew how to write it. It didn't write that exception.
Counsel, I would like to know what your claims are and what they're not, and what relief you are seeking. I'm looking initially at your emergency petition for original action, and am I correct that claims 1 and 2 are claimed statutory violations?
Correct.
Am I correct that you are not making then, I don't see any issues presented, of a constitutional violation?
That's correct, Your Honor. We think the Constitution is implicated by the statutory questions, but we are not raising constitutional claims. That's right.
In fact, I think you would acknowledge that constitutional claims, perhaps you may not have standing to raise certain First Amendment constitutional claims. Is that correct?
I could see that argument, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, you're also, issue number one points to Order 28, as does issue number two. I don't see any claim here requesting the invalidation of the order number 31. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's because Order 31, we understand to be an amendment effectively of Order 28. It is entirely derivative of Order 28 as Order 31 itself states.
Well, let's take a look.
So if Order 21 is out of the picture, then Order 31 has no operation.
Let's take a look, I guess, at the orders. Both Order 28 and 20 and 31 have a severability clause. Let me start with 31, though. That's what I was speaking about. What do you point to indicate to me that Order 31, other than sub A, which references safer at home in its phases, what's the language in Order 31 that you would say could not stand if Order 28 is invalidated in part?
I don't want to nitpick too much, Your Honor, but it's not that it wouldn't stand, it just wouldn't have any operation.
Well,
Order 31 is about, go ahead.
What about the language phase one will include, in other words, this gives the a phased approach to reopening the economy and society and sets out those phases. Why wouldn't those stand, given severability clauses, if you have any problem with sub A? I don't understand why it wouldn't stand, and yet you're not attacking it. It's not part of any claim you're making.
Your Honor, Emergency Order 31 purports to set the conditions under which Emergency Order 28 would be lifted. Emergency Order 28 says it expires on May 26. Emergency Order 31 says, well, unless the Secretary decides it's not appropriate to lift it at that point. What Order 31 highlights is that Emergency Order 28 could be with us for months or years. Emergency Order 31 is about when the Secretary might or might not see fit to lift Emergency Order 28. So Emergency Order 28 is the focus of everything, as I think DHS will even concede.
Why isn't the severability clause implicated with regard to 31 vis-a-vis any reference to 28?
I don't think the severability clause has any relevance one way or the other, Your Honor, because it just, go ahead, I don't want to interrupt you.
Yeah, I understand that's your position. I want to get back to my initial inquiry. So your claims are statutory. There's no constitutional claim, and it's an on Order 28. So what relief are you seeking on your first claim and on your second claim?
We are asking this court to issue an injunction as against Emergency Order 28. That would prevent the government from enforcing that emergency order. We have asked that the court consider issuing a 6-day stay to allow DHS sufficient time to prepare a new rule and to work with the legislature on a new rule. Unfortunately, DHS has done nothing as far as we can tell. They could issue a scope statement in a day, and as far as we know, they haven't even started work on it.
But
despite our asking them to do so.
So, as I understand it, I think virtually everyone that's written here that addresses the issue acknowledges that in order to promulgate an emergency rule take more than 6 days. I understood your change of language in your reply brief, leaving it to our equitable discretion vis-a-vis the length, to be an acknowledgement that 6 days will not do it. Am I correct on that?
Not quite, Your Honor. 6 days would have done it. 6 days would have been plenty of time had DHS started moving when it was supposed to have started moving. Unfortunately, as far as we know, DHS continues not to move, despite 227's mandatory directives.
What's the minimum time? And I'm looking at Appendix B in one of the amicus regarding the flow chart of emergency rulemaking process. What's your opinion of the minimum time required to go through these 13 steps, which include publication?
We think it could take about 12 days in this case. So we know DHS could write the scope statement in a matter of an hour. It could be 2 pages like DWD's scope statement issued yesterday was. We know that the Secretary of the Department of Administration and the governor would approve it in a minute. So now the 10-day period begins.
Now we have 1 hour and 1 minute, apparently.
That's right. That's right. We're moving quickly. Okay. So now we have a 10-day period that starts with the publication of the scope statement in the Register on Monday.
So that's the fourth step. Yep. Now the fourth step.
Right. And now the 10 days runs, and the agency immediately upon the end of the 10-day period issues the rule, which it could write in an hour.
What about 227.24.1E1D, which requires obtaining approval for the statement of scope from individual or body with policy-making power over the subject matter? And then the next one, drafting the rule, the next number 7, submitting it to the governor for approval, number 8, publishing the emergency rule in the Wisconsin State Journal, 9, filing it with the Legislative Reference Bureau, 10, submitting the emergency rule to the Small Business Regulatory Board, 11, then distributing it to the legislature, 12, holding a public hearing. So that's all done in how long?
The point A to point B that I'm discussing, Your Honor, is scope statement to the rule going into effect. That's a critical distinction. A number of the things you just mentioned, Your Honor, have to do with proceedings after the rule has gone into effect. The approval of the rule by the entity with policymaking authority is approval by the Secretary of DHS. Presumably, she's directed that the rule be written this way. So we know that's going to take about a second. So it's 10 days plus a day or two on the front end and the back end to allow for approvals and publication. And the rule at that point should be published and in operation, at which point the legislature can begin its oversight process, including the small business regulatory review that Your Honor mentioned, in addition to other things. There can be a hearing. In fact, there must be a hearing within 60 days that the agency runs. There are a number of procedures, but see, this is how the emergency rule statutes accommodate what we're dealing with here. They recognize that a rule can be put in place very quickly, and they give the legislature a seat at the table, but not a seat at the table before the rule is promulgated necessarily. It's a seat at the table once the rule goes into effect.
Could I follow up on something Justice Bradley just asked you? I heard you say your claims are statutory, and I understand that. But are you also conceding or saying that there are no constitutional implications to your claims?
Certainly not, Your Honor. The Constitution is at the core of our statutory claims. The Constitution is at the core of the legislative review process underlying 227, as this court knows from Martinez and Koshki and other cases.
Okay.
And also the Constitution, sorry, Your Honor.
I just wanted to make sure that you weren't conceding that there are no constitutional, or that there are no constitutional implications here, because I think you're implicit within your claims are constitutional ramifications of what's been done here. But I have two other questions that I would like you to address, if you would, and then I'm going to mute my button. There are penalties that are associated with violations of these rules. Emergency Order 28 provides for imprisonment, fine, or both. Does that have any impact on our analysis from your point of view? And also, what, if anything, should we make of local control under Wisconsin statute chapter 251?
Right. So first, on your first question about constitutional questions, I just want to be very clear that the legislature's position is that if these statutes are read properly, reasonably, as they were meant to be read, there are no constitutional issues because the legislature would then be involved and DHS would be acting within ascertainable boundaries and there would be no non-delegation problem. Amici have argued that perhaps the statutes cannot be read so narrowly, in which case they are unconstitutional. That's not our claim. We're the legislature. We like to think we can write statutes that are constitutional, and we have done so here. On the second point, Your Honor, I'll take the third point first, actually. So whether local governments can address the circumstances of the outbreak, absolutely. You have an amicus brief from Washington County explaining how local public health authorities respond to crises like this. The statutes allow for it. The statutes allow DHS itself to authorize local government officials to respond in the first instance. And they promote this kind of county by county approach as circumstances warrant, and not the one size fits all approach that DHS has seen fit to impose. Finally, on the question of penalties, what Your Honor mentioned means that there is no dispute, nor can there be a dispute in this case, that this emergency order has the force of law. DHS is wisely not contesting that point because the circumstances, the consequences of a violation are quite serious.
Counsel, I wanted to ask about your motion for temporary injunction here and just to follow up on some of the earlier questions. So if it's your position, an emergency rule could take effect in 12 days, best case scenario. Are you asking us to grant the motion for temporary injunction and stay it until that can take effect? Obviously, anything less than that would mean we are functionally the order goes away for at least some period of time.
Your Honor, I appreciate the question. It's tricky because it depends on when the court might issue its order, and I have no idea when the court might do so, but if the court were to do so next week and condition that grant on a six-day stay, that should allow plenty of time under our timeline. But if the court were to act more quickly, perhaps a longer period would be necessary. That's within this court's sound equitable discretion. It's not our call. We think 6 days.
I butt in with a question that has been on my mind. You've asked both that we conclude that Order 28 is a rule and it wasn't properly promulgated. Well, if you prevail on that, we have to say it doesn't have any effect, correct? But you're also asking us for a temporary restraining order. And if it's a rule, why are you asking us for a temporary restraining order?
We're asking you to stop the order from going into effect prospectively because it is an invalid, unpromulgated rule. We're asking the court to consider in its equitable discretion pausing that holding to allow DHS to get moving. We've urged DHS to get moving. They haven't gotten moving so far. That's unfortunate. But
so we could agree that it's a rule and simply strike it down, and that's the end of the story. There's no need for a TRO, right?
That's correct. You could declare it unconstitutional. That could be part, or you could declare it unlawful under the statutes. That could be part of an injunctive order. You're right, Your Honor. The takeaway here is that the order is unauthorized, and we're asking the court to say as much.
Okay. All right.
Counsel, are you asking that we strike it down and leave nothing in place, just open everything up wide?
I didn't
understand that to be what you're seeking, but if it is, let me know.
No, not at all. We've suggested, and I hope the court suggests to DHS, that they put together a scope statement by the close of business today so that we can move forward under the clear laws that have been enacted and that nobody has challenged here. We think the court could, in its equitable discretion, allow DHS some additional time to get moving, but there are irreparable harms on the other side here. Every day that DHS in this
administration proceeds as though they are not subject to 227, we are irreparably harmed as the entity that created DHS and gave it its powers in the first place. The public is also harmed because they get no input through an elected official other than the governor, but consider that the governor has only 60 days to respond. The people have no means to oversee this exercise of power that derives from them in the first place. That last point bears repeating and bears emphasis. The governor has 60 days after the declaration of an emergency under Section 323 to take drastic measures to confront an epidemic. That's 60 days that DHS could have been working on a rule to put in place once the 60 days expires. And that assumes that the 60 days would expire. Perhaps the legislature would extend them. The important point is that the governor is the chief executive, exercising executive power to respond to emergencies in a way that balances the need to move quickly, the need for dispatch, and at the same time, the need for legislative input on a drastic set of regulations that DHS here is putting in place. I don't know why the governor hasn't purported to act under his own authority. I don't know why they've forfeited that argument, probably because they think that they can't do these things for as long as they wish under that authority, but it just can't be that DHS has more authority even than the governor himself.
Counsel, if the order is in fact unlawful, why would this court put a stay on its injunction? Why would we let an unlawful order continue in place?
Your Honor raises a good point that if it's unlawful, it should be enjoined immediately. We are irreparably harmed by our statutes being not complied with. I take your point, Your Honor. We have simply conceded that given the equities, if there is a pause, if there is a period of 6 days during which this injunction is not enforced, that takes all of DHS's arguments off the table. So we've simply suggested that the court may wish to do that, but of course the court may wish to simply enjoin the order immediately because it is unlawful.
Counsel, what kind of chaos in your mind would exist if this court just simply said the order is unlawful and that's it? What are the ramifications for the people of the state, both north and south of Highway 29? I happen to live north. But what are the ramifications? And why haven't you asked for that?
The ramifications, Your Honor, are that the governor and his agencies, which derive their powers from the legislature, would need to sit down with the legislative branch to come up with a bipartisan, sensible response to this pandemic going forward.
Excuse me, if I might, I haven't been able to ask a question yet.
Yeah, I will yield to you for that because you haven't, yes.
Thank you. Counsel, as you know, the definition of a rule is a regulation, standard, statement of policy, or order issued by an agency to implement, interpret, or make specific legislation enforced or administered by the agency. I take a look at Secretary Palm's brief, page 45, where it says, Safer Home is not enforcing any legislative requirement. Could you respond to that particularly?
Yeah, it can't be right, Your Honor, because under their reading of their statutory authority, they have unlimited powers to respond to a public health crisis subject to no expiration date. And whatever else that is the police power. That is a legislative power that the legislature does not give away. And so the exercise of that power is not at all executive. It is the power to issue rules prospectively, indeed indefinitely, for the conduct of business, travel, et cetera, for the entire state. That's
so
a legislative power.
When I look at the order, and tell me if I'm looking at this wrong, I look at the order and I say, well, if a contested case were to come to our court for a violation of that order, what would be the rule of decision in the case? Would it be the order pointing to a pre-existing rule or statute that the order said that the person is supposedly violated, or would it be self-referential? Would it refer to the order itself as containing the identifying the prohibited action. And if it's the order itself that contains the identification of the prohibited action, and that prohibited action cannot be found in any existing rule or statute, would that necessarily mean that the order constitutes a rule?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It would be self-referential. There is no other rule or statute that contains these restrictions. No one would dispute that. That makes this case much easier than the case currently pending before the court regarding DHS authority. In that case, I happened to watch the argument. There's a lot of discussion about whether an FAQ relies on statutes and therefore is not so much a rule but simply a statement of policy. And maybe the agency is really just relying on those statutes in the first instance, so the policy isn't a rule itself. This case is not even remotely as difficult as that. This case involves an order that by its terms states that violations of the sections of the order carry criminal penalties. And that's why DHS has conceded that it has the force of law. And so, their only response, go ahead, Your Honor.
Yeah, so would it make sense to, when we're trying to figure out whether this is a rule, an attempted rule, or an order, would it make sense to ask, well, does it have its own standard that requires adherence by the public? Or does it point to a pre-existing rule or statute for the standard the public has to meet?
That would be a sensible way to approach it. That's how this court has traditionally approached it. And that's how DHS has itself conceded is an appropriate approach in that other case.
So, counsel, I want to take you back to this idea of the injunction that you may or may not be asking us for. Your idea is that if we put a pause on this, that the legislature is going to come to the table with the governor and what passed the statutes that they could already be passing, because there's nothing in this framework of rulemaking that requires the legislature's seat at the table in discussing what the policy should be for Wisconsin. So if he can answer my question, Chief Justice.
May I, Chief? Chief Justice, I can't hear you. I think you might be on mute. Chief Justice, may I answer the question?
Tell everyone to watch the little red button. Yes, please answer her question.
Okay. 227 itself gives the legislature a seat at the table. The legislature is preparing legislation even now to prepare to this crisis that we're in. But the fact is, if the governor can use his public health secretary to exercise the police power over the state indefinitely, the governor would never agree to any legislation. Why would he ever agree to legislation that would limit his power over the entire state? No, it's only through 227 that the agencies created by the legislature can act in this broad way, because their powers come from the legislature in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Roth, are you ready to go?
I am, Your Honor.
Please do.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Assistant Attorney General Colin Roth here on behalf of the respondent. In the midst of the deadliest pandemic the world has faced in over a century, the legislature asks this court to handcuff DHS's power to combat infectious disease. But they misread our public health statutes.
Counsel, as you begin your argument, I'd like to direct your attention to Article 1, Section 1 of the Wisconsin Constitution, which reads in part that all people have certain inherent rights. Among these are liberty. To secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. My question for you is, where in the Constitution did the people of Wisconsin confer authority on a single unelected cabinet secretary to compel almost 6 million people to stay at home and close their businesses and face imprisonment if they don't comply, with no input from the legislature, without the consent of the people? Isn't it the very definition of tyranny for one person to order people to be imprisoned for going to work, among other ordinarily lawful activities? Where does the Constitution say that's permissible, counsel?
The Constitution provides that the legislature may enact statutes to protect the public health, and that is exactly what the legislature has done in Chapter 252.02, sub 3, 4, and 6. So I think that expression of legislative intent that grants DHS the power to do whatever is necessary to combat a novel, deadly, communicable disease like the one we're facing today is where we find that consent.
Are there any statutory or constitutional limits on the powers of the secretary?
There absolutely are, Your Honor. I think there are a variety of ways in which DHS's powers are limited under these statutes. The first thing I'd say is a judicial review is always available to determine whether DHS has taken power, has issued an order that's exceeded the scope of its statutory authority. That is exactly what we're here today to do. There's also judicial review if DHS has taken action to combat an infectious disease that burdens fundamental constitutional rights, such as the freedom of assembly, the freedom of religion, the freedom to travel. And I would note that all of those claims are not in this case. To Justice Ziegler's question earlier, there are no constitutional claims here about substantive rights. I would say those are at issue in a case recently filed just last night in a petition for an original action to this court, but those are not in this case. That's another way in which DHS's powers are limited. Yet a third way through judicial review in which DHS's powers may be limited is the arbitrary and capricious review that's available for any type of review of agency action. If this court were to examine the nature of what DHS has done and decide that it's arbitrary and capricious and not reasonably tailored to the crisis that we face, of course, that's another means that could be used to invalidate the order.
But counsel, you're not really answering what I heard Justice Rebecca Bradley ask. She asked you if there were any limits on DHS's power. You're talking to me about judicial review. That's the powers out there and someone saying you went too far. But her question was, when DHS is deciding what to do, is there a primary limit that DHS imposes on itself or has imposed upon it by statute?
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize if I misunderstood the question. What I would say is if you examine 252.02 and the subsections on which DHS is relying, it's clear that DHS's actions are limited by what is necessary to combat the infectious disease that's presented at the time. And that's how the statutes are worded. Sub 6 is worded that way, and sub 3 and 4. Every single one of them says that when DHS faces an outbreak of a dangerous communicable disease, it can do what is necessary to combat that disease.
DHS and the cabinet secretary solely determine is necessary, right? Is that your argument?
Well, in the first instance, DHS is empowered. I mean, this is what the statute says. I mean, it says that DHS shall implement all emergency measures to control communicable diseases. I mean, that is what the statute says. It gives that power to DHS. This is the statute that the legislature chose to enact. So I think it is.
Give its power away? I mean, one of the things this order does is allow people to go to prison for leaving their homes unless it's okay with the DHS secretary. How can it be that an unelected individual has the power to declare otherwise usually lawful activity to be unlawful and to in fact criminalize that activity? I think our law is pretty clear that only the legislature has the power to criminalize activity, right?
Well, I think, again, if you look at Chapter 252, there is a provision in 252 that we've relied upon that permits for fines and imprisonment when orders issued under the powers in Chapter 252 are violated. Again, legislature chose.
If a defendant would come before this court charged and convicted of violating the Order 28, and it was brought to us that, well, that's okay because 225 permits this kind of conduct. Where would we look to determine whether the conduct that he did was actually a violation of the statute. Don't we have to look at the order to determine what conduct has been criminalized, not the statute? I can't find it in the statute. But if someone comes before us and that's the claim, we'd have to know, well, is the claim is, I didn't break any law. Well, how would we know if he did? We'd look at the conduct, but we'd have to compare the conduct to the order, correct? You don't find conduct in the statute.
Well, I mean, clearly the statutes.
What are the elements of the offense? If someone were charged with this crime or penalized for this, we'd look to the statutes for the elements of the offense. Do we look to the order for the elements of the offense? I think is another way of asking that question.
Well, if you look at the provision in 252 that provides for enforcement, I think it's that the element is a violation of the order. And so I mean, that's there's only one element. I mean, that's what the statute says. And well,
counsel, isn't that, wouldn't we have to conclude then that the order created the prohibited activity that is criminal if it is engaged in, right?
So I think we're approaching this question from what I think is the wrong perspective.
Whether it's the wrong perspective or not, could you answer my question?
So clearly when DHS perceives a novel and evolving a virus before it, and it looks at its authority under sub 6 and sub 4, it has to determine what is necessary to fight the disease. The legislature cannot possibly in advance predict all things that someday might be necessary to combat infectious disease. That has been recognized for over a century.
Let me just focus this a little bit more for you. So there's a prohibition against engaging in non-essential travel. That is a restriction contained in the order. And if someone engages in non-essential travel, they are subject to criminal penalty, correct?
That is correct.
All right. So the criminal behavior was created by the order, not by the statute, correct?
I don't know that it's a material sense. I mean, I think, again...
Well, counsel, I think you might want to think about that a little bit. It's a really material sense. When we speak about criminal penalties, we require that the standard pre-exist as a matter of law. And if the criminal standard is contained and created by Order 28, then the secretary, all by herself, created a criminal law. How would you respond to that?
Let me put it this way, Your Honor. I think if this court is concerned about the criminal liability implications of Executive Order 28, it could issue a ruling that simply says Executive Order 28 cannot be enforced through criminal prosecution. It can be subject to civil fines or civil right. action.
Right.
But
so I
don't think that undermines the fundamental nature.
I'm not interested in a severability answer. The question of the criminal sanctions is illustrative of what the secretary is exercising as a matter of power. She is, through this order, creating a law. The fact that it is punishable by criminal sanctions simply highlights the fact that she is creating a law. What I'd like to know is how is it that she came by the power to create law all by herself?
She is not creating law, Your Honor. I think what she's doing is, let me try it this way.
Now, hang on a second. Let me try it this way. So before the severability proposition that you made, you would, I think, have to concede that the reason that you would have to sever that is because she had created a new criminal law, correct?
I don't think so, Your Honor, not necessarily. I don't think this case has been teed up as somehow exceeding the DHS's authority to in some criminal law context. I mean,
it's been teed up.
I won't
whether she has the authority to to issue the standards that are contained in Order 28. The fact that it is punishable by criminal violation simply highlights the fact that she's creating new standards that did not exist before. If these are not new standards, if this is not a new law, then there should be no problem with the criminal sanctions, should there?
I don't concede that there are problems with the criminal sanctions, Your Honor. I think what this does is...
Okay. So your position, just so I make sure it's clear, your position is the secretary can identify behavior that is not otherwise criminal, and she can all by herself sit down at her computer keyboard, write up a description of behavior, and make it criminal, correct?
What I would say, Your Honor, is the legislature has created this statutory scheme itself.
So before you get to the justification, could you answer my question? She could do that, correct? She can sit down at her keyboard all by herself.
Yes, the scope of available enforcement is determined by the order, yes. I mean, that's true.
Counsel, what I hear you saying is we are in a pandemic. This is a horrible situation. The governor, through his secretary, has acted. The secretary alone has acted, has created this enforcement scheme. And you know what? It makes sense. So as a policy determination, the court should just say, okay, if it's okay in this situation because it makes sense. Part of the problem we have is we may personally think things make sense, but we have to apply constitutional principles and the language of the statute and the law to figure out whether it actually does make sense. Because tomorrow there could be a different situation. And if we agree with you that, you know what, this is a pretty bad scenario. We have this in place. People tend to agree that it's okay. So let it go. That's not our analysis. So we have to apply the law and the constitutional principles at play, whether this makes sense or not. That's the tough part of this job. It's not just what we think is a personal preference. How do you reconcile Chapter 252 and the authority that you say the secretary has, the criminal penalties that are implemented if this order is violated, along with the legislation that endows counties and local municipalities with the authority? How is this order not usurping the county's authority to manage COVID?
Well, on your, I'll take your first question, your second question first, and then swing back around. To your second question, 252.02 sub 4 says that the state can issue orders to counties and that they supersede local regulations when dealing with a statewide public health crisis. I think the statutes clearly recognize that the state and DHS in particular is the entity that has the ultimate authority over responding to a public health crisis. As to the larger question, I'd like to approach this a slightly different way. And I'd like to swing back to the mass gathering bans that were discussed during the opening colloquy. And what I understood the legislature to be saying is that a mass gathering ban is okay. Now, there may be some line drawing issues when you scale it up to a statewide order, but I heard the legislature concede that a mass gathering ban for Milwaukee County is okay. I don't understand how that concession squares with this idea that DHS has essentially no authority to do anything that is not, you know, specified in the statute itself. I mean, I'm looking in 252.02 sub 3, and I see the department may close schools and forbid public gatherings in schools, churches, and other places. So if DHS imposes a mass gathering ban and says no festivals of over 1,000 people in Milwaukee County for the next 30 days, I understood the legislature to be saying that that's okay. And that concession means that through the effect of the other portions of 252 that allows DHS to enforce the orders that it issues to control communicable diseases, that there may be civil or criminal sanctions for violating that order. So it's very difficult for me to understand why the idea that simply because the precise measure that is required to combat an infectious disease is not specified in the statute somehow means it's essentially beyond DHS's authority entirely unless it goes through rulemaking procedures. I think that fundamental
example, counsel, because one of the rationales that we're hearing justifying the secretary's order in this case is that, well, it's a pandemic and there isn't enough time to promulgate a rule and have the legislature involved with determining the details of the scope of the secretary's authority. I'll direct your attention to another time in history in the Korematsu decision where the court said the need for action was great and time was short. And that justified, and I'm quoting, assembling together and placing under guard all those of Japanese ancestry in assembly centers during World War II. Could the secretary, under this broad delegation of legislative power or legislative-like power, order people out of their homes into centers where they are properly socially distanced in order to combat the pandemic?
Your Honor, Korematsu was an equal protection challenge to the action that the government took to address the crisis. This is not a substantive constitutional challenge to what DHS has done. This
My question goes to the scope again of the secretary's authority and what the limits are. What I'm hearing is, well, the legislature doesn't need to specify the limits. It's a time of pandemic. There isn't enough time to go through rulemaking. So the secretary just has to do whatever she alone deems necessary to combat the pandemic. So my question to you in invoking Korematsu is not the basis for the claims that were brought in that case versus this case. The point of my question is, what are the limits, constitutional or statutory? There have to be some, don't there, counsel?
Yes, there absolutely are, Your Honor. Justice Bradley, I think if you read the petition for an original action that was filed with your court just last evening, there are a variety of fundamental rights-based claims that target different pieces of Executive Order 28 on the basis of the freedom of religion, the freedom to travel, and I don't know all what's in there. It's a long petition, but there's a lot of constitutional rights in it. That is one of the fundamental backstops against an unreasonable and unconstitutional exercise of power by DHS. I don't think you can ignore that.
Counsel, that's not answering my question. I understand, we all understand that people have the right to come to this court or another court to vindicate their constitutional interests. What I'm asking, set aside the Constitution for a moment then, what are the statutory limits on the Secretary's power? Because I'm looking at page 45 of your brief, and you say that section 252.02 is not legislation enforced or administered by DHS through issuing Safer at Home, and DHS's actions did not implement, interpret, or make more specific standards that the legislature designed by statute. Section 252.02, according to your brief, simply empowers DHS to act. What are the limits on the powers of DHS to act? What can't DHS do under this statute?
Your Honor, I think you take the statutory text as it is, and the statutory text empowers DHS to take all necessary action to combat communicable diseases. I understand Your Honor may be uncomfortable with that broad grant of authority in the sense that you think it may allow DHS to go too far. I humbly submit to you that that concern is best addressed to the legislature and asking them to amend the statute that they passed and lobby them to add limitations of the kind that Your Honor is discussing.
Let me just follow up, please. I have one more question. I think it goes to the heart of what this case is all about. And as I understand the legislature's argument, the legislature is asking us to construe the statute so that there isn't a constitutional problem because, counsel, I think there is a constitutional problem with the legislature giving away this much power to an unelected cabinet secretary. The people never consented to a single individual having that kind of power.
I would respond in two ways. First, the DHS cabinet secretary serves at the pleasure of the governor. She is clearly accountable to the people in the same way the governor is. The second thing I'd say is the people chose to grant a broad power to the state's public health agency to do what's necessary in a pandemic to fight it. Courts for over a century have recognized that legislatures, I really encourage you to just think about it. Think about what—
Yeah, counsel, I've talked a lot about it. And concern again goes back to what the limits are on the secretary, because under your interpretation of the statutes, she can do whatever she wants and she can order people to jail if they don't comply. And I don't think the legislature can give that kind of power to an unelected individual.
Your Honor, what I can say is for over a century, courts have recognized that in the context of infectious diseases, it is practically impossible for the legislature to be able to predict exactly what is necessary. You have to keep in mind, this is a novel, it is literally called the novel coronavirus. We have never seen it before. We don't know exactly what it can do. And so the legislature realized that it needed to give an agency with the ability to respond with expertise and alacrity to changing dynamic circumstances on the ground.
The logical consequence of your argument, counsel, is that the government could step in and do this. The DHS secretary could step in and do this every single flu season, every year, because the flu kills tens of thousands of people in America every year, and that's a communicable disease. So would you agree with me then that the DHS secretary, under your interpretation, could be empowered to do this every single flu season?
No, Your Honor. I think the DHS secretary, if it tried to do that every flu season, would have no support in the medical community for imposing that kind of restriction.
So the then limitation on
they
her
tried. They so tried. The
counsel, I would like to ask you the same question.
I'm in the middle of a question.
When we're in this format,
I couldn't try to ask one for 10 minutes.
I have some order. I know Rebecca Dallet, Justice Dallet, has been trying to ask. So
amen.
We're going to start, give you a little seniority, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. You go first. Justice Kelly, you go second. Justice Dallet, you go third. Try not to ask too many follow-up questions so you each get a chance. Justice Bradley?
Thank you. I want to ask you the same question that I asked your opposing counsel. The Wisconsin legislature has brought a lawsuit before this court asking us to invalidate Rule 28. I asked if this court, because of the lawsuit brought by the Wisconsin legislature, would invalidate 28 and leave nothing in its place, kind of flip the switch, so to speak. What kind of ramifications or chaos would result? Your opposing counsel said, well, then the politicians would have to come together. But what kind of real logistics, health, and lives are implicated if that's what this court would do upon the invitation of the Wisconsin legislature bringing this suit?
Your Honor, everyone understands that such an order would be absolutely devastating and extraordinarily unwise. And that is exactly why the legislature asked for a 6-day stay of any order. It understands that if safer at home is enjoined with nothing to replace it and people pour out into the streets, that the disease will spread like wildfire. And we will be back into a terrible situation of an out of control virus with no weapon to fight it, no treatments, no vaccine, nothing. This is exactly why the legislature decided that a public health agency needs flexibility to act in these extreme circumstances. I think if the legislature decides that after it sees this crisis pass, that more limits need to be placed on DHS's authority in the statutes, it has every right to do so, and I'm sure it will. But in the midst of this crisis, to toy with the statutes that DHS has, that the legislature has passed, I think you can tell from the concession that the order should be stayed that the legislature has made. You understand exactly why they made that concession. It's because people will die if this order is enjoined with nothing to replace it. That is exactly what will happen.
Counsel, if I understand correctly from your answer to Justice Rebecca Bradley's question, the limitation on the secretary's authority that you see is the support she might get in the medical community or some other internal process that she might have in deciding what's appropriate and what's not. And is there anything other than that? I mean, there's just, in your mind, there are no statutory boundaries that she has other than she says this is for addressing a pandemic. And with that, she has complete authority to create new standards of conduct, describe new prohibitions on otherwise lawful behavior. There is no limitation on that.
Look, Your Honor, of course, any agency cannot act in an arbitrary and capricious manner. I think that is an implicit limit on everything that an agency does. And so
I'm not interested in the arbitrary and capricious. I'm trying to figure out what it is we would be measuring arbitrary and capricious against, right? So when we look at arbitrary and capricious,
hang on a second.
When we look at arbitrary and capricious, we are comparing that to a standard, right? And determining whether the agency's actions have complied with those standards or not, whether it's fairly within boundaries of those standards. What we're trying to figure out is what are the boundaries of the standards that the secretary mm-hmm. believes in which she right. can act. And what I'm hearing so far is there are none so long as she believes it's necessary to combat an infectious disease.
I don't think it's so easy to brush that away as nothing, Your Honor. I think these statutes are tailored toward a narrow circumstance where you have the quickly evolving spread of a communicable disease, and the actions that DHS takes must be tailored towards stopping that particular circumstance. That nexus is the standard that the court would use when reviewing the specific action that DHS has taken.
So the standard is, if it relates to an infectious disease, that's the standard, right? She can do anything she wants as long as it relates to trying to control an infectious disease. That would be the standard.
And it's not anything she wants. She is constrained, as all government actors are, by the Constitution and fundamental constitutional rights, such as the freedom of assembly, the freedom of speech, the freedom of religion. Those are all bounds also. And I simply disagree with the premise that those are meaningless or impose no strictures on what the secretary can do.
Well, and what I'm trying to get to with that is I'm trying to compare it to the legislature's power. The legislature is confined by the constitutional limits as well. What I'm trying to figure out is, does the secretary exercise 100% of the discretion that the legislature does in creating new prohibitions on activities?
I'd like to try to answer your question. I promise you this is the purpose of what I'm about to do. I'd like to just give you a brief analogy to illustrate why I think what's going on here is executive action in response to a temporary evolving crisis.
I get
imagine
that.
This was a
folks, you have to, if we don't proceed, we're not going to accomplish anything. So
I would like to hear his answer.
I'm going to call on you, Justice Dallet. That's what I'm here to do, okay?
I understand, but I would like to
have the opportunity, Justice Dallet, to answer the question that was posed.
Yes.
When he finishes that answer, then you are next. We won't ask yet another question.
I am not asking another question. I am asking that he be able to answer because Justice Kelly keeps cutting him off. So okay. I would like to hear it. That's
Justice
my question
Dallet,
too.
Justice Dallet, please allow me to conduct my own questioning. Counsel, you can use your analogy after you answer my question.
You're going to have to repeat your question, Justice. I apologize.
Go on to Justice Dallet. I'll come back to it.
Okay, Justice Dallet, please proceed.
First of all, I'd like to hear your analogy.
And
then I have another follow-up, but go ahead.
I think the premise of Justice Kelly's question is, if you're setting out new rules of conduct, it has to go through rulemaking or new standards for conduct. And my response to that is, imagine that there's a wildfire that breaks out in southeast Wisconsin, and it starts just spreading all over the place. We can't get it under control. The fire department decides it needs to set up fire breaks to stop the spread of this wildfire. So it says, you know, you need to close this highway and clear out these businesses and evacuate here, cut down these trees, demolish these homes. I mean, those are rules of conduct in the exact same way that Executive Order 28 is. Yet I don't think anyone in it could reasonably say that when we're fighting a wildfire and trying to contain it, that somehow the fire departments are engaging in rulemaking-like activity. Now, I understand the point about, well, these are enforceable through you know, criminal sanctions, but in the same sense that when the fire department tells someone to evacuate because it needs to create a fire break, well, if the person doesn't evacuate, the fire department has to do something to get them out. It has the authority to set up the fire break it needs to address the evolving emergency on the ground. I see no fundamental difference between that and what Emergency Order 28 does. The COVID-19 virus is a wildfire that's spreading across the state, and DHS is the fire department that the legislature has empowered to fight that fire. And that fire is still burning. It's still smoldering across the state. And when we start lifting these restrictions, it's going to pop back up. And I see no world in which rulemaking is going to be an adequate tool to combat such a quickly moving threat. And that, again, this just demonstrates the wisdom that the legislature showed when it passed these statutes, giving DHS the authority to do this. I think, again, for 100 years, courts have recognized that in the public health context, it is impossible to predict exactly how one would need to respond to a new crisis. And therefore, when the legislatures use their police power to grant authority to the executive to respond to these instances of crisis. And the idea that because a statute is passed under the legislature's police power, that the individual acts of execution under that police power statute are somehow legislative power, I think is absurd. All you have to do is look at the criminal law statutes. Those are passed under the legislature's police power, but I think it would be news to every DA that when they enforce a police power criminal statute, they're engaging in legislative activity. I mean, it's absurd. So to Justice Kelly's point, I mean, the fundamental question is when an executive agency responds to a crisis and acts in a way that affects more than one or two people, it cannot possibly be the answer that the executive response to the emergency is a rule. And I think you heard that in Justice Hagedorn's colloquy with my friend on the other side. This idea that we can issue an order to Milwaukee County to shut down and that's not a rule, but somehow in order to the state is, there is no principal dividing line between the two. That is a new rule of conduct punishable by enforcement under the other provisions of 252. I don't know what the distinction
is. I have a follow-up as well, Justice Kelly. Counsel, we've been talking about all these hypotheticals. You've been bombarded with that for this entire questioning. Is the legislature as a legislative body the entity that brings those type of issues before us, that puts a framework on what the boundaries are for violation of rights? How can the legislature step in on behalf of someone, an individual, and make those claims?
Well, if Your Honor is making a standing point, I agree 100%. I don't think the legislature has standing to raise a claim that DHS has exceeded its statutory authority. I think certainly a regulated business or a regulated private party would have the authority to raise such a claim, but the legislature is harmed in no way by the idea that DHS has exceeded its statutory authority. The rulemaking claim, I'm not going to make that argument. They've given themselves a procedural rulemaking right, so I think that probably suffices. But these statutory authority claims, I absolutely think the legislature has no standing to.
So the limits that we're talking about are ones that could be defined just as any other statutory limits are often defined in the course of litigation brought by individuals who believe that the statutes have been exceeded, that the authority of the statute has been exceeded. Is that the framework that you would put this in?
That's exactly right, and that is the thrust of my answers to Justice Rebecca Bradley, is that there are limitations on these powers. And this court will be considering them in very short order. I assure you that you will be receiving briefs within the next week on the fundamental constitutional questions that are raised by Executive Order or Emergency Order 28. And those are the limits that are there. And that's how this process is supposed to work.
But the process isn't supposed to work where the DHS secretary can enter an order that blatantly violates constitutional rights or statutory provisions. And, well, people of Wisconsin, you're just going to have to file a lawsuit to vindicate those rights. That's not the way it's supposed to work, is it?
I think the way it works is the DHS secretary follows the law. She follows the statutes. She follows the Constitution to the best of her ability, which is exactly what she's been doing. And if people think she's exceeded her authority or has violated a fundamental constitutional right, they'll sue. That's how the system works. I would like for a minute to...
Did you ever answer my local control question?
Justice Ziegler, I thought I did, and perhaps I went over it a little too quickly. My understanding is if you look at 252.02 sub 4, it expressly says that the department may issue orders for any city, village, or county. And then it says rules and orders that are issued under this subsection supersede conflicting or less stringent local regulations, orders, or ordinances. So I think what 252.02 sub 4 shows is that the legislature has decided, very wisely in my opinion, that the state public health authority is the preeminent one with the power to as it says, supersede conflicting local decisions.
Not just conflicting, but less stringent, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And I think that's exactly right when you see a virus like this one that does not respect county boundaries. I mean, this started out predominantly in Madison and Milwaukee, and we just had this outbreak in Brown County very recently in the meatpacking plant. This is after Safer at Home. The cases in Brown County in the span of 2 weeks surged over tenfold, from 60 to almost 800. And that's 2 weeks that would be required for emergency rulemaking. So,
due to the meatpacking, though, that's where the Brown County got the flare. It wasn't just the regular folks in Brown County.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but the point I'm trying to make is that these flare-ups, when Safer at Home is now steadily lifted in stages, are going to happen all across the state, and they're going to happen very quickly. It's like a wildfire. It's smoldering, but a gust of wind is going to, you know, fan the flames, and it's going to, you know, explode again. I mean, that is exactly what's going to happen. You're seeing it all around the world as these restrictions are lifted. So I think the world that this court is being asked to put us in is one in which we have these smoldering wildfires exploding into massive infernos, and DHS is not going to have the ability to react. It's going to have to go through the rulemaking process.
Yeah, so I'd like to return to the question I had before, the comparison between the legislature's authority and the secretary's authority. And what I'm particularly interested in is the scope of the secretary's authority to prohibit conduct in comparison to the legislature's authority to prohibit conduct. And perhaps to put a finer point on it, take a look at 252.02 sub 3, where that specifically gives the secretary the authority to close schools and churches to public gatherings. And so the legislature defined her ability to prohibit conduct. But where would she get the authority to go beyond what the legislature had described in 03 and create new forms of prohibited conduct? Is her authority to do that coextensive with that of the legislature?
The legislature has, I mean, I would like to talk about sub three. My time is almost up. I have 5 minutes, and I really would like to focus on sub three for the remaining 5 minutes of my time.
Could you do that in the context of answering my question?
I'd like to, because I do think that there's a lot of agreement actually between the two sides on sub three. And I think that's crucial to recognize. As I read sub three, this is from the legislature's brief. This is what they think sub three allows. This is from the legislature's brief. It allows the DHS to ban, quote, gatherings of a substantial number of people in relatively close contact for a prolonged period of time in a defined, perhaps even enclosed space. I agree with that. I agree with the legislature's reading of sub three. That is a very good definition of what sub three allows DHS to do. And so I think it's crucial to go through exactly Safer at Home does and how it fits within how I think a lot of Safer at Home fits within the legislature's own definition of sub three. Let's start with large public gatherings. Well, clearly the statute says schools and churches.
Before you go, that's a really long analysis to go through all the prohibited.
I promise you, Justice Kelly, I will do it in my 5 minutes that I have left.
Well, I don't, but I'm not really interested in hearing that. What I'm interested in is hearing what is the scope of the secretary's authority to define prohibited behavior in, vis-a-vis the legislature. And in particularly, I'm interested in having you explain that in relation to between 252.02 sub 3 and all of the other activity that she has prohibited in Order 28. Can you do that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think... the legislature itself has defined the activity as best it can in advance. It has said the department may close schools and forbid public gatherings in schools, churches, and other places. The legislature itself has defined the activity that may be prohibited. It could not possibly list in a list, 50 pages long of every kind of activity that could conceivably fall within that broad definition. The legislature can only do so much. So it did what it could. It used and other places. We can use our Euston Generous canon of construction to understand what the legislature meant when it said and other places. And I don't think the legislature disagrees with that. I think if you read their brief, this is the framework of analysis that they have adopted for sub three. And we endorse it. I think they're exactly right. I don't think that they're right in interpreting exactly how far it goes. But I think the framework they've established is the correct one.
So do you understand that all of Order 28 is justified by the authority granted under sub 3?
No, Your Honor. And that's what I would like to discuss in my last 1 minute and 50 seconds. I think large public gathering bans are covered clearly. The legislature concedes this. Schools, churches, athletic events, concerts, rallies, parades. That's either from the statute or from the legislature's brief. I think that's undisputed. We have to have that power. That's what O3 says. That's what the legislature says. We agree. I think it also extends to festivals like Summerfest and Bratfest. Clearly, those are large public gatherings that fit within the legislature's own definition of sub three. I think we can all agree on that. Where I think we part ways is businesses that are open to the public, like a restaurant, a bar, a retail establishment, or services like salons, things of that nature. It seems to me the legislature disagrees that sub three extends to those types of activities. I simply don't understand that disagreement. I would encourage you to review the definition that they've given of gatherings of a substantial number of people in relatively close contact. That applies to any retail store where people are cramming together. My Ace Hardware Street down the store, I know there's a lot of people in relatively close contact. That's not a big store. Any restaurant you've ever been in at happy hour, crowded, bar, crowded, that falls under sub three and the legislature's definition. I'm not saying we can close it. Closure is limited to schools under sub three, but I think the mass gathering ban piece of Emergency Order 28, which is a crucial part of this order, falls directly within sub three and the legislature's own definition of it. The only other element of Emergency Order 28 I would mention is large gatherings of private individuals such as weddings, funerals, and frat parties. I mean, again, those are all situations that fall well within the legislature's definition of sub three. It's not limited by private property because churches are mentioned in the subsection, which are obviously private. So I think sub three justifies a material. I think it's probably 75% of what Safer at Home does. What it does not cover is small private gatherings, ordering people to stay home in the travel ban, and actually closing businesses. That is the only piece that I think falls outside sub three. And so I think I would encourage you to look very closely at sub three, the legislature's definition, and what Safer at Home does. And if this court is inclined to strike down portions that can only be justified under sub four and sub six, which is everything else, you have to leave sub three standing. That is what the legislature said in 252.02 sub three. And I think the legislature has practically conceded 98% of that. So any order should not go beyond that. And I encourage you, look, this is a temporary injunction that we litigated in a week. I mean, you can't hold us to exactly what the brief says. You've got to look very closely and not issue a decision that's too broad. That's all I have to say, unless there are any further questions.
Thank you. Are you ready for rebuttal, Attorney Walsh?
I am, Chief Justice. A few points. It is remarkable to me that the Department of Justice has not mentioned once the governor's broad emergency powers under the emergency statutes. The governor declared a state of emergency on March 12th. Section 323.12 sub 4b gives the governor authority to issue any orders that he deems necessary to protect property and persons. The Department of Justice argues today that you should read DHS's enabling statute is broader than even that grant of authority to the governor, which is subject to legislative oversight. By a joint resolution, the legislature gets a seat at the table after ensuring that the governor has sufficient time to respond to the emergency. That 60-day period is not up yet. It continues. It continues until May 11th.
Counsel, is it your position that that these orders could have been issued by the governor in the same form under the governor's emergency powers?
The governor has broad authority to take drastic measures. That question is not presented here. Certainly, the governor has far broader authorities than DHS, which is the creature of the legislature, Your Honor.
I'm understanding your argument that that you're making that by reference to maybe the scope of statutory powers, but I'm unclear about how the governor's emergency declaration is particularly relevant to the question of whether either it's a rule or whether, or quite frankly, rather it exceeded the scope of its statutory, the scope of 252.02.
It's relevant because DHS has argued to this court that if this court enjoins an invalid, unpromulgated rule, there is no recourse for the people of Wisconsin. The 60-day period is not yet concluded. The 60-day period began in March, and DHS could have begun promulgating the rule months ago. This isn't March. We're in May. Our argument is that we now get a seat at the table because DHS is attempting to do something even broader than the governor himself is claiming he has power to do. That is a rule. Put aside the cases that fall closer to the line. This is the broadest, most sweeping order we know of in Wisconsin history. The agency, for whatever reason, chose to go it alone without relying on the governor's authority, extending its own authority beyond the 60-day period. That is why we're here today. That's why we're trying to figure out what we have to do. It's because the agency, for whatever reason, has dug in its heels. It didn't start on a rule in March.
Counsel, are you arguing that DHS has no powers under Chapter 252.02 past the 60 days?
No, not at all. We think DHS has a number of authorities beyond the 60 days. The problem.
Which authorities does it not have after the expiration of 60 days?
Well, for one, it can't ban private gatherings. We know that from sub 3. The expression of one thing is the exclusion of the other. DHS is given authority to ban public gatherings and preventing, and that includes the power to prevent public gatherings from even forming in the first place. But that doesn't mean a blanket ban on all forms of gathering, whether at a private residence or at a private business. So the DHS has enormous authorities under its statute, but those powers cannot eclipse even the governor's. And unfortunately, that claim wasn't addressed, nor was the question whether DHS could get started today on issuing a rule by putting together a scope statement, starting the 10-day period, and ensuring that the legislature has a seat at the table. And to Justice Dallas' point, it would ensure that the legislature has a seat at the table because knowing that JCRER has authority to review this provision under a number of statutory bases means that the governor and the legislature have to sit together and work on what Wisconsin's comprehensive bipartisan response to this pandemic will be. There's no way around that under Chapter 227, especially under an order that is this sweeping. Finally, you've heard it said that,
Your opposing counsel indicated, and your briefs so indicate, that there's much of 28, Order 28, that remains in effect even under your 25202 challenge. So let's take a look at that. What you've said in your brief on pages 46 and 55 and 47, that other places under 252023 include more than just churches and schools, of course, that are mentioned. What else does it include? Does it include the libraries that come under the operation of Rule 28?
Counsel, your time is up, but you can answer Justice Bradley's question.
Thank you, Chief Justice. To be clear, the order on its face is invalid as an unpromulgated rule. If DHS were to start over, and again, it should have started over a long time ago, they could do a number of the things that they have purported to do under this emergency order. We have said that they may prevent public gatherings from occurring. That is clear. With respect to schools, churches, and other places like schools and churches. So there are a number of things DHS can do, but it has to work with the body that gave it its power in the first place. That is the key point, Your Honor. Denying the injunction here would mean that the governor and DHS get to exercise unlawful authority for as long as they want while relying on data that they refuse to disclose, all the while denying the people's elected representatives a role in addressing the long-term response to this pandemic. That cannot be the law. Thank you, Your Honor.
Are you requesting that this court invalidate Order 28 in its entirety?
Justice yes, Bradley, I am, Your Honor.
His time is up. You can answer briefly, please.
Yes, Your Honor. The Emergency Order 28 in its entirety violates Chapter 227 because it is an unpromulgated emergency rule.
Thank you, counsel, and thank you very much. I know participation like this can be tiring. It's tiring on this side of the bench, too. And you both did a very good job, and I also appreciated your briefs and the materials that you submitted to us. They are very, very, very helpful. It's complicated questions that are presented here. And in addition to that, there's an awful lot of emotion that's tied to them because we are in the middle of a pandemic, which all sides agree on. So I thank you very, very much for your assistance to the court. We are going to adjourn now, and the court will meet in closed conference at 1:30. Thank you.